Okay, so we have a half hour or so, or 20, 25 minutes or so for conversation, and what a terrific group to start that conversation. Please, if you're not known to Father Brennan, please please introduce yourself before you begin. Yes.
Hey, Frank. Frank Mercier from the Law Faculty. So I'm struck by many things from the clip you showed, and among was how articulate you are in a setting like that. I'm just very, you're a great spokesperson for a complex position. But I wonder how, it seems like any time someone in your role stands up for anything that could possibly have happened with the church's name on it is fair game from the point of view of the interviewer. How do you prepare and manage something like that, where you could be called in for, excommunicating Galileo or something?
Well, I mean, basically, I've always taken the approach that, you've got to have the confidence and the hope that the truth will set us free. I can go on an interview like that, and yes, I might stuff up big time, or something might be exposed which I wasn't previously aware of. Well, fine. That's unless you're prepared to do it on that basis, then I'd say just don't do it. Now, I mean, often the prudential decision is whether or not to give an interview. And that's like stepping away from that issue for the moment. For example, one of the areas where I've often said I can be of use to Aboriginal Australians is I can go on and do the interview where I can name the issue as I see it. And if I'm wrong, government can just say I'm wrong, because there's nothing standing behind me, which is their constituency, that they risk offending. But if they remain silent, the prospect is that what I've stated is correct and can be a helpful articulation of the parameters. I might just give one example. And often it requires as much work behind the scenes as in front of the camera. You may be aware that in 2008, our then new Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, made an apology to Aboriginal Australians. Now, as it was, he phoned me in late 2007, just before his first cabinet meeting. He said, "What do we do about the Aboriginal apology?" Well, I'm Prime Minister. But one of the things I said to him, I said, well, there'll be two very critical issues with Indigenous Australians. One will be, do they want this done quickly, or do they want it done as the result of an extensive consultation process of the new government with various Indigenous groups? And secondly, will they see the question of apology as being linked to the question of financial compensation, or are they seen to be separate questions, and that therefore one can proceed with an apology, leaving in abeyance any question about things of that sort? Now, I then said to him, I said, well, I think these are the sorts of questions. Probably what I can most usefully do is write an opinion piece in one of the mainstream broadsheets, just raising these issues, and then if there's no great agitation about it, then you know you've got a green light to proceed. And that's what happened. Now, I think that's a useful service which is respectful of all parties in trying to find a resolution of a question of that sort. Now, coming back to this sort of clip, I mean, as you'll appreciate, one of the problems for someone like myself is, I mean, I can't go on there and say, look, I speak for the Catholic Church. I don't. I'm not a bishop and I never will be, and there'll be some bishops who will say, well, thank God, he never will be. But at the same time, there'll always be at least a sufficient corpus of people in the church, including some bishops, who'll say, well, thankfully, we've got someone like that who's able to be out there and to engage in the public square so that we can at least be assured that the strength of our tradition and the strength of our position, such as it is, can be put out there for due scrutiny.
Yes?
I'm Adam Thomas. I'm in political science.
Hi.
Something I've been following, I guess, for the past year or so, and it's come up recently again, is this question of morality clauses in contracts for Catholic school teachers, especially in San Francisco now is the latest instance of this. And I guess it plays out in America, it seems to me, along the lines of, as a consequence of our Bill of Rights, the question of ministerial exceptions for employers versus rights to non-discrimination on behalf of employees, and that sort of is working out in the courts. Is there an equivalent dilemma in Australia? And is it playing out differently, this question of, as more rights are extended to gay and lesbian people, problems of churches employing practices?
There is. It doesn't play itself out in constitutional terms,
right.
But it does in terms of, we have a fairly robust legislative regime for implementing faithfully the international conventions on discrimination. And this then means that churches over time have pleaded for various exemption clauses. And one of the key exemption clauses has been for particularly the Catholic Church asking for exemptions in relation to what you might call lifestyle situations of teachers in Catholic schools. But it hasn't applied only in the educational context. And in fact, I think there was a case in Australia the other day where there was a woman who had admitted to being in a series of relationships, I think they were heterosexual, but where it was said that she was not a suitable person for employment in a church welfare body.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these things get played out in terms of what would be the scope of the exemption which would be provided under the state legislation. And those exemptions are being increasingly narrowed, and I think it's only a matter of time before they're abolished completely. One of the things you'll appreciate is, unlike here, in Australia there is very wholesale government funding for the running of church operations, particularly church schools, and so the difficulty has been resolving what is the correct balance between accountability to the state and the liberty of the church to conduct the organisation according to its own ethos.
Do you think it's a positive development for those exemptions to be narrowed?
I think it is, but I do think there are some cases where if exemptions were to be applied, if I might say, in a non-discriminatory fashion. I've always, in that where there's been the one in terms of gays and lesbians, I've always had a pretty offhand approach to this where I've said to people in the Australian Church, well, I mean, if we were applying the same scrutiny to heterosexual couples who we think are living in irregular relationships, or, you know, God forbid it, if we even thought they were practicing contraception, where would it all end? And so, given the incoherence of that, I think that ultimately there's got to be a drawback of those exemptions.
Yes?
My question really has to do with the relationship of Jesuit education and the remarkable... I'm not going to tempt you into indiscretions about this. But we find ourselves in Australia in a remarkable situation at the moment where we have probably more Catholics in Parliament than ever before.
Yes.
And where we have a Jesuit-educated Prime Minister and a Jesuit-educated leader of the opposition. I mean, in this kind of environment, you might be able to share, or I might be able to get you to share just a few reflections about that. At one level, it looks as if you could even look at Australia and say, here's an interesting case study of what happens when Jesuit-educated people find themselves in positions of extraordinary power. And is there anything we can learn from that?
Mm. Thank you, Michael. Well, I'll answer it anecdotally. Our Prime Minister is a man, Tony Abbott, and as you've said, he was educated at a Jesuit school. He's often said that the two great mentors of his life were his father and a Jesuit by the name of Emmett P. Costello. And Emmett died aged 89, going on 90, and he died about 6 weeks after Abbott was elected as Prime Minister. Well, I was to be the preacher at Costello's funeral, and Tony Abbott was to give the eulogy. And so I commenced the homily at the funeral by saying that Emmett P. Costello, in his 90th year, had always wanted to remain on this earth to be able to witness the events of the federal election. And so he was alive for the election, and then he remained amongst us for about another 40 days and 40 nights. And having seen that all was accomplished, he's now enjoying his eternal reward. And I went on to point out that at that stage in Australia, those who were Jesuit educated included the Prime Minister, the Leader of the Opposition, the Chief Justice, the Treasurer, the Minister for Finance, the Minister for Education, and the Minister for Agriculture. Now, what I didn't say in the homily, but which I have said to some of my Jesuit brothers since, is, does it make much difference? I don't know that it does. And this is the difficult challenge for us. That these are, I mean, the government in Australia at the moment, if you were to take, for example, the issue of refugees, on which which Jesuits have traditionally been very strong since Pedro Arrupe was Father General with the Jesuit Refugee Service, the treatment which this government has accorded to asylum seekers is a disgrace, an absolute disgrace. Someone like myself attempts to engage in discussion with Tony Abbott about this sort of issue. It's that, Frank, we need to do this. We'll treat them decently, but they have to get the message they can't turn up here without a visa. And so it's said that if you want to stop putting kids in detention, you want to stop drownings, you've got to stop the boats. And to stop the boats, you've got to take very draconian measures. And so the prospect of trading on the Jesuit education, I think there's not a big dividend for it. But having said that, I would say that one should not lose hope that where there has been that education which has been provided, there is at least an acknowledgement by them of the rhetoric and something of the substance, and hopefully in their consciences at some stage they'll come home to that. But in terms of real political outcomes, could I say that I remember years ago when John Howard was the Prime Minister, and at that stage there were, once again, six or eight Jesuit alumni in his cabinet. And I remember speaking to a meeting of the Jesuits of Australia, and I said, well, these are the facts. I said, now, in the areas I work with Aborigines and with refugees, they say this is the toughest government they've ever had to deal with. So now, does it make much of a difference that there are Jesuit alumni at the table? I said, well, we could use the Evelyn Waugh defence and say, well, we don't know how much worse they'd be without the Jesuit alumni at the table, but I don't think it quite works. So in terms of the dividend, which is provable, I'd say the jury is out.
Others, yes?
I'm just wondering, Frank, that in terms of being kind of effective in the public square, does that presuppose a certain amount of sympathy already in the square for the message that you want to convey?
It does and it doesn't, Oliver. I mean, I think, and maybe this is something of the prophetic element from time to time, if it's sympathy for the message to be conveyed, it's, well, you're just going with the flow. And what's really value added becomes the question. I think there are times, though, when you can be there in the public square where you can be putting the proposition which is, if you like, countercultural. You can be putting the proposition which doesn't enjoy the immediate adulation of, you know, the soft left opinion group in the community generally. So I think it can cut both ways.
But why should people listen to you then?
I think people should listen. Well, I mean, it's not that they should listen. Why would people listen? Well, put another way. How would you want to present yourself in the public square so that you think you might be useful? And it is because you say, well, I come, hopefully, with a commitment to truth and a commitment to values and a tradition which are enduring and which actually can provide a value-added significance to the public discourse which is to be undertaken.
Yes.
I'm Sarah Hood. I'm from the School of Social Work here. So I wanted to go back to your experience when the individual pointed out cardinal law. Do you find yourself often in situations where you're defending or feel ashamed or feel that you need to have a response to people? And what do you say when people approach you and are very angry about the Catholic Church your support for it?
I don't find myself feeling a need to defend as such, but, I mean, definitely there are times like that, feeling ashamed. Often, for me, I want to make sure that that I've done the work within the church and behind the scenes where it's known where I stand, and that then I'm in a position, it can't be said that I'm disloyal to the church, but at the same time I think that the church needs to improve radically in these regards. And I think in that situation, there's absolutely nothing wrong then with being able to admit one's shame. And I think in terms of defence, I mean, I'll offer defence where I think it's warranted. And I mean, I do think, I mean, there are some elements in the media in Australia, definitely, which are anti the Catholic Church, and I can understand that. I mean, particularly the history of some of the other things that have gone on in Australia of late. But given that that antipathy is there, I think I'm not worried about saying, well, look, let's put the anti-Catholic bias to one stage and let's address the substance of the issue. But in terms of the substance of the issue, yes, there are serious shortfalls here, and yes, I feel greatly ashamed.
David.
Frank, one issue occurs to me in light of your presentation, thinking about the issues here in the United States and whether or not there are analogies in the Australian setting. I mean, the image of the Catholic Church in the United States connected with the sexual abuse crisis and so forth has been very, very bad. And there's also an identification with some fairly conservative issues like gay marriage opposition and abortion opposition and so forth. At the same time, the Catholic community in the United States is probably the single strongest voice in favor of protecting the rights of immigrants to the United States. And then there's a whole series of other issues regarding inner city poverty and development in the third world. And so there's a host of, I mean, there's a huge spectrum of issues here. Now, the same is true in Australia, I would take it. I mean, I know that your work on Aborigines and on defense of the asylum seekers coming into Australia has been very powerful and very forceful versus the rather bad record of some leadership in the church on issues like sexual abuse and so forth. I mean, how does that sort itself out in terms of public opinion? I mean, your conversation so far has really implied that the media and public opinion is basically has a negative view of the church and it makes you ashamed to speak about these issues. But there are other issues on which you are very deeply committed where the church is in some sense the only or even the strongest actor on these questions. How do we sort that out in terms of the different voices within the Catholic community and the different initiatives and how to find a way to make the impact of the church not be overshadowed by these negative issues, although they clearly must be dealt with. I don't want to suggest that at all, that they shouldn't. But you see what I'm getting at, about the complexity of attitudes and actions on both the church side and the attitudes in the public opinion sphere, how that can be sorted out.
Well, I don't know that it can be sorted as such. I mean, I probably take some consolation going back to what I quoted from Benedict and Deus Caritas Est, that it's a situation of let a thousand flowers bloom, and that, yes, there'll be some church leaders who rabbit on about this particular issue over here, but, well, at least people like Brennan are out there doing something about Aboriginal rights or refugee rights or whatever. Now, in trying to develop something which is more coherent for the church as an institution, I must confess, I don't invest much energy in that. I don't expect, I mean, years ago, I mean, I started work as the advisor to the Australian Catholic Bishops on Aboriginal Affairs, and it'd be about getting them to make statements in support of Aboriginal rights or whatever. Now, it's no disrespect to them, but it's basically, on things like Aboriginal rights, I don't wait for the bishops to make a statement, because by the time they make a statement, it'll be such a self-evident statement that everyone embraces anyway, that with all respect to them, it won't make one iota of difference. So in terms of sorting it out, I suppose the question is, what are we wanting to sort in terms of what's the outcome that we're seeking to achieve? Now, part, I think, of what's going on at the moment is that a lot of the rhetoric which the church has had in the public square about justice has been turned back on the church itself. And so then the question has been, how can the church be halfway credible? I mean, I often come back, for example, the issue of women in the church. I mean, I have 21 nieces and nephews. I think most of them are nieces, and they're all very bright and well-educated. And, I mean, relating to them, that generation, about why would you bother engaging with the Catholic Church as a social institution which does not have women there centre stage with men, then it's a fundamental structural question now of justice and of coherence in the public square. Mm-hmm. So I think what I'm saying is that I don't know that it can be sorted, but I don't lose any sleep that it can't be sorted. But I think that what's needed is for a greater investment of resources and a greater assurance that those who are in the public square agitating for justice for the marginalised and the oppressed, that they will be seen to enjoy the warrant of legitimacy, that this is as much the voice of the church as any other voice which is out there on the other questions.
One last question. Yeah, Greg.
Greg, I wonder if you'll say a bit more about comparative constitutional architecture, and whether you remain a fence sitter, where you sit these days on the issue of Bill of Rights or judicial enforcement. And you know, it's sort of interesting to, you noted that there's different ways of dealing with some of the social issues, maybe the practical effects are the same, whether it's a judicial outcome or a legislative outcome. On the asylum seeker issues and refugee issues, the courts haven't always been so helpful in Australia. There's deference to what Parliament has done. What do you think these days about that question of a Bill of Rights and judicial enforcement? And is there...
Well, one of the things I've been looking at while here is the question of physician-assisted suicide. Because, as I say, perhaps a little too facetiously, once your court has dealt with same-sex marriage, it undoubtedly will move on to physician-assisted suicide. And the Supreme Court of Canada dealt with it definitively a couple of weeks ago. But the more interesting case for me is the House of Lords and the Supreme Court in the United Kingdom. And in terms of constitutional arrangements, I've been strangely attracted to what I've seen in the UK on two fronts. They're locked into the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights, and that has helped to inform the jurisprudence of the UK Supreme Court, but with a margin of appreciation for Parliament being able to steer through various rocks and difficult places. Now, the decision which the UK Supreme Court gave a few months ago indicated that because of concerns for human rights of a particular group, that is, those who suffer disability but who are autonomous individuals and who want to be able to end their lives at a time of their determination, then the UK Supreme Court has said that there is a need for some legal policy regime which is respectful of their wishes. But they've still their hand at the moment on that, which your court would not be able to do. And they basically said, well, let's wait and see what the House of Lords comes up with. Now, I've always had the view that the House of Lords are a group of old fuddy-duddies in that they're all, you know, they're not elected, they're nominated there, and it's reward for all sorts of things or whatever. But my God, if there's something the House of Lords is very expert on, because they're all old fuddy-duddies, is reflecting on dignity and dying. And, you know, you've got people there like Baroness O'Neill, a very fine philosopher in her own right. When you've got people like that engaging in the discussion, it's been a very rich discussion, far richer than you'll ever find in a US Supreme Court decision or the Canadian Supreme Court decision or in an Australian Senate committee discussion. And so what I'm saying is that I do think that the deficit in Australia in terms of the absence of a Bill of Rights is lamentable when it comes to things like the treatment of asylum seekers. I'm still not of the view that the American full constitutionalisation or the Canadian equivalent would be the way to go in Australia, and that I don't think we've got the cultural acceptance. I mean, we're just too irreverent towards unelected officials, and the idea that judges would decide some very contested moral questions, I think, is not on. But as I say, what I've seen in the United Kingdom with the mix of the debate in the House of Lords and the developing jurisprudence in the UK Supreme Court, I have found quite attractive.
Well, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you for your work in the public square, and especially for your work here today. If you haven't gotten dessert or lunch, please do so. But before you do, please help me thank Father Brennan. Thank you.